I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection.
You need to go somewhere where you can get a genuine rest. And you're very lucky. The best place in the world for someone like you is less than a half an hour from here.
You don't mean Claymore.
Susanna, 4 days ago, you chased a bottle of aspirin with a bottle of vodka.
I had a headache.
Our guest, Susanna Kazin's girlhood, was interrupted when she was packed off to a mental institution at the age of 18. She was diagnosed with the so-called borderline personality disorder. In long hindsight, Susanna Kazin thinks maybe you could well have called it adolescence. It was 1967, when arguably the whole world was crazy, and she may not have been any crazier than anybody else. She was saner than her hospital mates at McLean Hospital in Belmont, outside Boston. She was saner than the girl who lit herself on fire, saner than the girl named Daisy who checked herself in seasonally to devour laxatives and roast chickens. Susanna Kazin writes in her memoir, "People ask, how did you get in there? What they really want to know is if they are likely to end up there as well. All I can tell them is, it's easy." Susanna Kazin's story, which has been made into a movie starring Winona Ryder, explores the ambiguous line between madness and sanity, between the disorderly, ordered world of a mental hospital and the chaotic culture of the late 1960s. Connection listeners, what was the line between suffering teenage angst and serious mental disorder? Is Prozac now the sort of equivalent of Susanna Kazin's 2-year stay at McLean Hospital? Are we more susceptible to diagnosis of mental illness when the world around us seems to be falling apart? The connection phone is 1-800-423-8255. Our guest is Susanna Kazin, author of Girl Interrupted. By phone later in the program, we'll be joined by Jim Mangold, the director of the movie. Susanna Kazin, welcome. This is a fascinating book we've all been talking about around here. What was your state in those days, and how is it today?
Well, it was a sad state when I went into McLean. I think I was quite sad, and I've certainly had a lot of sadness since. I think I'm a melancholic person, but I don't know if that's crazy or not. It depends how long the melancholy goes on and what you do with it. And I've been a lucky melancholic. I'm melancholic about half the time. So the rest of the time, I'm not.
What does that mean, you're melancholic half the time? What do you do when you're melancholic? How do you feel?
I don't like to do anything. Nothing is pleasurable. I don't do anything particularly different when I'm not melancholic. It's just that I enjoy it.
To lead to a sort of a cut to the chase question, Do you take antidepressants?
Are antidepressants
related to the kind of diagnoses and treatment that you got in the 60s?
Well, that's a complicated question. I don't take antidepressants. These sorts of antidepressants that now exist didn't when I was hospitalized. And they certainly have changed the world in many ways, some good, some bad. I do think one of the questions you asked in the beginning is, have these antidepressants replaced hospitalization? And I think for many people they have, and probably that's a good thing. I think it's very disruptive to be hospitalized for a long time. It's disruptive to be hospitalized for a short time because there's a stigma attached to it.
There's also a common thread, though, of the uncertainty of these diagnoses, the tremendous fluidity, shall we say, more than ambiguity of the words like borderline personality disorder, whatever in the world that means. That would be enough, though, to get a prescription for all kinds of antidepressants today. And you wonder, what in the world is the hard substance of this understanding, even after, 35 years of neuroscience?
Yeah, well, psychiatry isn't a particularly hard science. I don't think that means it's a bad science. But it's not a hard science. You can't take an X-ray and say this person has a fracture of the tibia and this is what we do. It's not that simple, and I don't think it's simpler yet than it was then. Maybe it will be eventually, but I don't think we understand the brain well enough at this point to make more than general statements about it. And you know, it's an art. It's an art to know how to heal the wounded. Is an art.
Still and maybe always.
Probably.
I want to go back to the mid-60s and late 1960s when you were growing up. What went wrong in this girl's life? And where did the institutionalization at McLean sort of fit among the many wrong things here?
Well, I don't count it as a wrong thing.
You don't?
No, I don't think it cured me because I'm not really that different from what I was when I was 18, although I'm older. Much and slightly wiser, but you know, it didn't cure me.
What was that girl going through? I mean, what was the problem?
What many girls go through, I think.
Okay, that's a key point. But what was it?
Oh, that feeling that you just don't understand what the point of life is, or how you fit into it, or what you could do that would be useful and enjoyable, that would make use of your own abilities and give anything to the world. I think many adolescents, not only girls, feel this way. Confused, deeply confused. Not ready to grow up, sick of being a child, not clear where to go, how to fit in, whether you even want to fit in. Not understanding yourself very well, I think, is the hallmark of that time of life.
It was a parallel universe, as you write about it.
Well, that's another question. That has to do with stigma. That has to do with the separation of people who have any kind of quality or disability that is frightening to other people. And I, when I list the parallel universes, I say there are universes of dying people and universes of criminals and universes of people in loony bins. I think that there are conditions that are frightening to most people, conditions we don't want to have. We don't want to be ill. We don't want to be on the verge of death. We don't want to be locked in a prison or a loony bin. Rightly so. I mean, who would want to be in any of these conditions? And I think that once you go into that condition, you're separated from society. And that's it's like a stain. It's very hard to erase that stain. It sticks on you.
The question with which you tease your readers is whether this kind of fundamental confusion about who you are, what you can or will contribute to the world, that deep confusion, a kind of active confusion, is the badge of sanity. Is the badge of, I mean, you didn't go to college. You say, your friends today say, well, how cool, how chic, how smart, how wise, perhaps. Were the reactions you went through up to at least the flirting with suicide, the dwelling on suicide, were they healthy responses to confusing world and a confusing time?
To some small extent, yes, I think they were. But you know, self-destruction and the tendency towards self-destruction is not a healthy response to feeling inadequate to the demands made on you. You know, I think had I been more rebellious and less self-destructive, it would have been healthier.
But you're also saying that so many people go, so many girls and maybe boys too, go through this. There is something throughout your whole book that's trying to encourage us to kind of normalize this understanding of a young person.
Well, I guess that I don't like to demonize depression. I guess I feel that depression is part of the human condition, and that it's been pathologized lately to a great extent. And I think some depression is part of life. But it can get too much, and it's very difficult to determine when it has become too much, when it becomes an illness that should be treated or dealt with in some way, and when it's normal responses to the stresses and difficulties of life. I mean, life is not an easy experience. People don't sail through it. There's a lot of trouble in life. Depression is not an unreasonable response to many of the experiences in life. And that kind of confusion, and I don't know where I fit in, I don't know what I'm supposed to do, is one way the anxiety and the misery and the floundering, you work your way through it. At the end, you know something. If you don't flounder in that way, you're not going to find anything out. So I think some of this is the process of growing up. The problem is that it's very hard to, it's not cut and dry. You can't look at somebody and say, this person is just going to be fine in 2 years because we know from these various signs that everything's okay. And this person who exhibits the same signs is going to continue to feel this way for the next 20 years. And that's dangerous. You can't tell that at 18.
Can you tell about yourself in hindsight whether you belonged in a mental institution or not?
No, I can't answer that question. I've been asked it many times, and it's meaningless to me because I was there. And it was such a formative experience for me that I can't say I wish it hadn't happened. It taught me a great deal.
Formative how? I don't quite get that in the book, which I've read carefully. In certain ways, you seem outside the experience a lot, and you know perfectly well that you're not as crazy as the people who are cutting themselves or acting out or...
Yes, I did know that, and although, you know, not everybody in the hospital was quite so nutty at that point. I mean, there were other people about as crazy or not crazy as I was. The reason it was formative was because it is formative to be cut off from the world and to be stigmatized and to have a different life trajectory than your peers, and it gives you a different outlook on life. It certainly gave me a different outlook on life, and I think it's what made me into a writer. I think that I had to learn to tolerate being quite outside the norm, and I had to learn to be okay with that. So it was easier for me then to pursue a career that until very recently didn't do much for me, although now it does.
Speaking about what it does for you, I want to ask you a different sort of question. You're sort of on guard against demonizing depression or over pathologizing it. You don't romanticize it exactly, but the combination of the book and the movie, I think, makes it in a strange way entertaining. And I puzzle about this. What it says about us, maybe the guys in the world too, that can make something entertaining out of a young woman's borderline insanity. The entertainment value of nearly suicidal anxiety in a teenage girl. I mean, there's something... Oh, God, I don't want to say pornographic about it, but it's approaching a kind
exploitative.
Of insanity porn.
It's exploitative, yes, I agree. On the other hand, I have to say, let's not be too earnest. I was in there for 2 years.
I'm always on the verge of being too earnest, so...
Well, it's important not to be. The reason I wrote the book, if I had a reason, was that I felt... People do demonize, earnestize, over-romanticize, do all kinds of heavy loading onto the issue of mental health, a term I loathe. At any rate, I felt, you know, people in mental health...
We used to say about Spiro Agnew when he was vice president, he was eternally at the verge of mental health.
Yeah, well, he didn't make it. What I wanted to communicate was that people, even people in mental hospitals, have to get up and take a shower and decide what to do with the day. You know, that everybody's got to live. Everybody's got to eat breakfast. Everybody's got to brush their teeth. Everybody's got to get through the day somehow and get into bed and go back to sleep and get up and do it all over again. And whether you're doing that as a, you know, as a writer, whether you're doing that as someone who works in a factory or you're a teacher or whatever, even in a loony bin, you have to do that. And I wanted to transmit the flavor of daily life with its ups and its downs and its humor. In a mental hospital, and there was quite a lot of fun. We had a lot of fun. A lot of teenage girls, high spirits, sexual energy, totally frustrated. You know, we had a good time a lot of the time. We played pranks on each other and the staff. We knew how to get people's goat, and we did it. We were bored. We were locked up. It wasn't all so terrible. There was a nice
camaraderie. Well, but that's just, again, the sort of puzzle. And I'll be terminally earnest again, but, I mean, is it a little too easy for the rest of us to find a kind of amusement in that predicament? There's an echo here of Ophelia, I think. The sort of the spectacle of a girl going nuts. It maybe is an old theatrical bit, but it seems a little too easy for the audience.
Well, yes, humor is a way of putting distance between yourself and something you're afraid of. That's well known. But, you know, I guess I don't think that's a crime. It's not a crime.
There's a wonderful passage in your book where you talk about all the things that go through a person's head when they're asking you, oh, you were in a mental institution.
Mm-hmm.
And the kind of personal, I mean, our own anxieties as we ask that question and follow it up with things like, you know, why in the world were you in there? Or what was wrong with you? You say that translates as meaning, when I ask that question, I need to know the particulars of craziness so I can assure myself that I'm not crazy.
Yeah. Well, I
what is the interest of other people in your past?
Well, I think because I look fairly normal and I sound fairly normal, they think this must have been a mistake. You know, there can't have been a good reason, a solid reason for her to be hospitalized. Otherwise, I, who look and sound fairly normal, might be jumped on by the men in the white coats and dragged off too, I guess. I mean, I think that's one of the fears, that because I don't twitch and drool and I make sense and I've written a couple of books, that how can it be that I was so disconnected from normal life that I could be hospitalized? But I mean, I think a lot of that does have to do with the time in which it happened. I think that it was a terribly unstable and nerve-wracked and quite miserable time, although the 60s also are greatly romanticized lately. I found them pretty scary. And I think many people who are honest who lived through the 60s found them scary. They were scary. And, you know, a lot of social instability, you don't know what to do with people. You don't know what's going on. I mean, I write quite a lot about that in the book.
You do indeed. I guess Susanna Kazin was the girl interrupted, the author of the book and now the movie, starring Winona Ryder, about her own experience being clapped into McLean Hospital in 1967. She was a teenager.
Yeah, I think it was 67.
and there for 2 years on, shall we say, rather arguable or examinable evidence of mental disturbance. 1-800-423-8255 makes the girl interrupted connection, or 1-800-423-TALK. Frederick is on the line.
Good morning.
Good morning, Frederick.
Pick up the fan phone,
will you?
I'm sorry?
Would you pick up the phone? I mean, are you on a speaker?
This is the best I'm doing.
Okay.
I was thrown into an institution down in Long Island, New York, and I believe I was treated more or less like a piece of trash that was, unwanted. And I knew damn well there was nothing wrong with me. The people in there knew there was nothing wrong with me. It was just a matter of a convenience for a parent who could afford to, like, disguise a problem of communication. And, it is revolting to me. It took me years to overcome the disruption in my life, and I find nothing sanguine about it. And to talk about it now, it just raises my ire. To listen to it, it's just sort of like this like a hemlock that you take. It's okay. The problem's going to go away. And then everyone in there is like looking at you like, oh God, what a sin that a person like that is in there.
Frederick, how long ago was this?
When I was a kid.
But how many years ago?
67, 68, 69.
Oh, same period. And what was the diagnosis?
Incorrigible.
what was your response? And did you get a chance to give it?
Well, I mean, I was a kid. I was frightened out of my wits. You know, I knew there was something wrong with me, right? You know, I knew when I looked at a girl, it said, you know, like, wow, that's good, right? And I looked at something like a car, I'd say, ooh, that's good, right? I mean, I knew the right from wrong, and I knew pleasure from pain. It's all of the key elements were working, and
How long were you in there?
I was in there for about, I'd say, 3 seasons, and then I was shipped off to a boarding school loaded with heavyweights down in Pennsylvania somewhere. Devereaux, I think, was the name of it. And, you were under guard all the time, et cetera, et cetera.
But your take on sort of what was going on was something that you were being disposed of by your parents.
Yes. It was obviously that's what it was. I mean, there were people who were in there. I was at the Rice Pavilion over in Bellevue. I forgot about that. But they hauled me off over there originally, right? I found out what a ball is in a second. They used that to calm you down. And because you don't know where the hell you are and what's going on, and you're scared out of your wits, and you're taking all these ridiculous tests.
I should say, Frederick, one of Susanna Kazin's opinions is that families use... even among the patients that she lived with, can use a single member as a kind of designated hitter for the family's insanity or the universal insanity that sort of will put the tag on you, pal. Is that your story?
I can't be wrong. Somebody's got to be wrong, right?
Right.
I mean, if I'm going to kick the dog and the dog dies, well, who gets kicked? Hmm. I mean, I understand that's probably, you know, something in there, right? But I mean, isn't there like, it's sort of like bombing the Chechens and comparing it to Kosovo, right? It's like, don't take any prisoners, man. I just wanted to, you know, call, you know.
Frederick, thank you. Yeah. Susanna Case, I wonder, did you feel at McLean that there were others like you? I mean, most of the people you describe, perhaps not Georgina, but others were demonstrably ill. How many people were in your sort of category of sort of borderline diagnoses of borderline disorder?
Well, there are two questions here. But let me say that I don't write very much about myself in the book. I try to protect my privacy, so you don't really know how ill I was or wasn't.
Hmm. Why didn't you spell it?
Because I didn't want to. Because I don't think it's anybody's business. Oh. Although I know that seems like a crazy thing to say. But
the girl in the book is not terribly crazy. Was she not crazy enough for the truth?
Don't you think I'm just kind of protecting myself?
I didn't read it that way. But I should have probably.
Well, I don't know. I can't say absolutely I was protecting myself and there I was just as crazy as everybody, but I was pretty
But you
unhappy.
Weren't ingesting roast chicken after roast chicken after
no,
chicken
I wasn't.
or I hope you weren't burning your flesh with cigarettes and
no, I wasn't doing that. But I guess I don't think those things are so crazy.
Hmm.
The other thing I want to say, I want to say something about borderline personality disorder, which I don't really understand it, but it's a diagnosis that is used quite differently now from the way it was used in the 60s. It was really used in the 60s as a kind of garbage pail diagnosis akin to hysteria. You know, it's sort of, we don't like the way she's behaving. She's got too many boyfriends. Maybe she's taking drugs. We don't understand what's going on. This kid is mixed up. Whereas I think now it is used more for young women who have been sexually abused, or so I hear. I mean, I think that it has really shifted. You know, the what I call the manual of style, the DSM, the thing that lists all the psychiatric diagnoses, which for my many years as a proofreader, I refer to it as the manual of style. It has changed quite a lot. And I have a chapter about that, too, about the changes in the DSM over the last 30 years. And a number of things have come out. A number of things have gone in. Shifting.
Surely the argument in the book is that young girls were treated differently than young boys. And your mention of hysteria, which is from the Greek related to the uterus, suggests a kind of systematic eternal bias against the females in the game. Is that the right way to read it, and is it still as strong as ever, do you think?
Well, I think more women are depressed, and I think more women are depressed because women have less scope and less power in society, and I think that will take a long time to change. And you know, I think life is slightly more frustrating for women, and frustration causes depression and various other ailments of the mind.
1-800-423-8255. Annalise is on the line.
Hi, Christopher. How are you this morning?
Good, Annalise.
Thank you for having me on. It's a great discussion. I haven't read the book. I probably will eventually. I think depression is a good thing. I think it gives people texture. And definitely teaches people something. My specific question is related to something you guys were just talking about. The title of the book is Girl Interrupted, and not Person Interrupted or Teenager Interrupted. It's Girl Interrupted. And I wanted to ask the author why she titled it that. And
there's a reason for it.
Yeah.
Doesn't come to the end of the book, but it's a very interesting point you make.
Well, it's a reference to a painting by Vermeer.
Mm-hmm.
With the title Girl Interrupted at Her Music. So I took the title of the book from the title of that painting for reasons that, if you read the book, you will see when you read the last chapter. However, I also was a girl at that point, so it seemed like an appropriate title, since it was about what had happened and what I had seen in my life.
Annalise, I'd like to read from the end of the book, not to give anything away, but it's a beautiful passage. Maybe you should do it yourself.
My glasses. Wait a second.
it's a reflection on two Vermeer paintings, actually, in the Frick gallery in New York. I'll just get it started, where the picture of the girl interrupted at her music. Interrupted as in music, Susanna Kazin writes, as my life had been, interrupted in the music of being 17, as her life had been, snatched and fixed on canvas, one moment made to stand still and to stand for all the other moments, whatever they would be or might have been. What life can recover from that? I'd love you to read just from the bottom of the page there about the other two paintings.
The other two are self-contained paintings. The people in them are looking at each other. The lady and her maid, the soldier and his sweetheart. Seeing them is peeking at them through a hole in a wall, and the wall is made of light, that entirely credible yet unreal Vermeer light. Light like this does not exist, but we wish it did. We wish the sun could make us young and beautiful. We wish our clothes could glisten and ripple against our skins. Most of all, we wish that everyone we knew could be brightened simply by our looking at them, as are the maid with the letter and the soldier with the hat. The girl at her music sits in another sort of light, the fitful, overcast light of life, by which we see ourselves and others only imperfectly and seldom.
You write beautifully.
Thank you.
Susanna Kazin is our guest. Her book is Girl Interrupted. It's now a movie that won a Golden Globe Award last night. After the break, Jim Mengold, the director of the movie and the screenwriter, will join us. We're talking about the very fuzzy borderline between sanity and insanity in a teenage girl. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI, Public Radio International. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com. From Boston.
Susanna, you're not crazy. Okay, you don't need to be here.
I tried to kill myself, Toby.
What? You took some aspirin.
I took a bottle of aspirin.
Wait, and that buys you a year in this place? Susanna, they're breaking you. All right? Everything's changing, man. What do they know about being normal?
I have friends in here.
Who? Them? Those girls, Susanna, they're eating grapes off of the wallpaper. Okay, they're insane.
They are. I am.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. Susanna Kazin, our guest, wrote the book Girl Interrupted, from which our guest from California, Jim Mengold, has made a movie. Angelina Jolie won a Golden Globe Award last night for playing the part of Lisa in the movie. Jim Mengold, congratulations on your awards last night.
Thank you.
Haven't seen your movie, but we're tickled that you're joining us on The Connection. What drew you to the book as fodder for film?
To me, it was an incredible, dense, mysterious world that was really inviting to explore. Full of character, full of life, full of, as you were discussing with Susanna, full of humor, but also full of a kind of insight that I hadn't seen in movies, particularly psychoanalytically themed movies, if you will.
What were you comparing it to?
Well, there's a long history of movies about what you call the quote-unquote troubled protagonist.
People are calling this the One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest for girls.
Well, people tend to call. I mean, you know, my last movie was, Prince of the City meets High Noon, and the previous one was Sunrise meets the Pawnbroker. I mean, the media has a way, because they only have 9 words after listing the cast, the awards, and the budget level of the movie to describe the movie, so that tends to be what they say. But I don't really find it, and never felt, Milos Forman being a great friend of mine and a teacher of mine, that I was ever kind of treading on what I consider to be one of the great films of all time, let alone about a mental institution. Milos's movie, Cuckoo's Nest, was in a sense an expose. It was kind of the dramatic titty cut follies that was pulling back the curtain on the kind of cruelty and hypocrisy that was a part of the state mental institution, the world of state institutions of the 60s, and really it was true of the 70s, and could even be true now, and was certainly true in the past. For me, Susanna's book was a real, well, much more of a personal journey, and the institution she was sent to was, while there were plenty of painful things that happened, it wasn't a place where people were being hosed down and straitjacketed and shut in rooms all the time, in the sense of a kind of a state dumping ground for criminals who were less knowledgeable about their crimes. It was
an interesting point, but I'm not sure I agree with you. Susanna Kazin, herself, I read the book as kind of an expose, locking up a teenage girl on rather thin evidence of mental disturbance. She says now she didn't feel it that way, but our caller before the break, Frederick, certainly read it that way, and he read his own experience that way.
Well, of course Frederick saw it that way, because he lived that exact life, and he had his own agenda he was bringing to understanding Susanna's book. I mean, hey, Susanna, are you there?
Yeah, I am. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, I mean, Susanna, you jump in whenever you want, but I think the book is, I mean, look, when you read your average expose, you know, Jeffrey Toobin's work on Bill Clinton or whatever it is, these things begin a certain way. They don't begin... This is an incredibly lyrical, personal book. This is not something where Susanna's running down the litany of misdiagnoses and this is a journey. And
what I think I was doing, of course the author is the last person to know what was really happening, but I believe I was doing this. I was for a number of years married to an anthropologist, and we did field work together. Well, I mean, I didn't do it. I just watched him do it. I was trying to make a village study of the hospital. I wanted to do an anthropological study of the hospital as a microcosm, as a village, and that was my intent. I thought, gosh, I went to this strange place and I should write a report about what it was like. Now, of course, I couldn't really maintain that kind of distance on it, that observer, non-participant distance, because I was a participant, but I certainly wasn't writing an expose.
Well, okay. Realize how to figure that out. Jim says it was a journey. It's a journey begins in a locked cab. First, we're talking about a pimple, and then, you know, you're going for a couple of weeks rest, and then you're locked up for 2 years. That sounds like the start of an expose to me. But
McLean wasn't a horrible place to be. I mean, just because I didn't want to be there doesn't mean it was a horrible place to be. And I was back there last week when they asked me to come back and speak. I always do, because I'm fond of McLean. I love McLean. McLean is my alma mater. I feel about McLean the way you feel about Yale or wherever you went. It grew me up. You know?
I have to say, I mean, it's when you ask me what inspired me to get involved, and I start to tell you, then you tell me, well, that's not true for you. That's fine. But I have to say that I see a contradiction in what you've been saying to Susanna, which is on one side, you're kind of dipping your foot in whether the film's like too, quote, entertaining. And another side, you can't help but call it an expose. And so there's a level where it's kind of got to be one or the other. And I think that part of what makes the film really entertaining is it's about this young woman's journey and the amazing characters and people and things that happen to her, and the contradiction of kind of growing up in a place where you didn't exactly want to be growing up. And that yet, because we're all, as human beings, we all make the best of where we are. In many ways, Susanna found both the best and the worst of this place she spent 2 years of her life, and I think has the courage. I think it's much easier to write the kind of standard, and you'll have a very big cheering section of people who will just kind of applaud as we talk about this unrightful kind of Midnight Express internment in an institution, which is part of the book. But the other part of it is that I think Susanna was courageous enough to talk about what good came out of it and what poetry came out of it as well.
Oh, well, that's well said. Susan Cheever's blurb for the book, and I mean her review of the book, said it all, I think, in the way we frame this story nowadays. It's not pictured as an expose. It's pictured as a story that, as Susan Cheever said, is poignant, honest, and triumphantly funny.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I just sort of want to risk terminal earnestness here and say, does that reflect our kind of entertainment appetite? Let's see a really funny movie about a teenage girl going wacko.
But I don't think the movie isn't that.
Patch Adams. We didn't make some kind of a. I think that we're digging here for things that don't exist. I think the movie puts an audience through a very intense struggle and asks a lot of intense questions. I think the fact that there's points where the movie is funny is part of making it about people who are alive and breathing and have charisma and life inside them and passions inside them, as well as, I mean, I didn't want to make a film, and frankly, nor did Milos or anyone else who's ventured into this particular territory where all you do is watch people stare out windows depressed and look at others twitching. I mean, I think that, and when we talk about humor in life, we have to remember that it isn't always at the expense of those people on screen. I think very much of the characters on screen. I think what humor there is in Girl Interrupted is very much, I hope, used to ask some of the same questions that some of the more dramatic moments.
Jim Mangold, I'd love you to stay for a question or two from our listeners.
Sure.
1-800-423-8255. We're talking about the book and the movie Girl Interrupted with author Susanna Kazin. Yes.
There was one thing, when you asked me about what attracted me, and I was talking about psychoanalytical films, there's one thing I did really want to say. I don't know if a question will lead us there, but it's just...
Give us the answer anyway.
Yeah, I'd like to. It's that almost all the movies about troubled protagonists have what I call the big secret, which is the third act ending where Good Will Hunting, my dad burned me with cigarettes, ordinary people, my brother died in a sailing accident, it's all my fault, you can go back to Marnie, my mom was a hooker and murdered a sailor, that every one of these clouds that enters the life of these troubled protagonists has a kind of really sweet little nut of a reason behind it. And I wasn't interested in making the film in necessarily throwing out the idea that a traumatic incident can cause us to have a troubled period in our lives. But what I was really interested in is that sometimes you can't either find that incident or it isn't there, and you can still enter that spiral. And I thought I had never seen a film that tried to wrestle with these issues where it didn't dollop out a third act bombshell, and then by confessing that bombshell, the protagonist was magically healed. And I felt that was always kind of too easy.
Jim Mangold, stand by. There's the answer. Let's hear the questions from the connection audience. 1-800-423-8255. The Girl Interrupted connection. Linda is on the line.
Hi.
Hello, Linda. Welcome.
Thank you. I was in McLean the same time Suzanne was, approximately, and I was 17 or early 18 at the time, and my diagnosis was adolescent turmoil.
The old AT diagnosis.
And I think I was there like 8 months or something like that, and I went to school there for a while, and they had a poetry magazine. It does change. I was there several times, but long periods of time, but it does change your whole, it's sort of like you're sent away because you're an embarrassment, and there were a lot of affluent people there who were extremely intelligent and very normal, but were sort of put there to sort of save the family or whatever. I don't know. I'm explaining myself correctly. But there was a very large bonding in there, and people cared about each other, and you did grow up, I think, quite quickly.
Linda, let me ask, do you think of it now for yourself as a kind of with an expose mentality or a kind of personal journey?
It's definitely a personal journey. It's just you have no one to share it with, and it's something that like we should have a reunion or something. And I remember getting second meds at night with one of my roommates. It was like having a cocktail in the evening and
yes,
vanilla
is,
Coke.
This is the flavor I was trying to capture. It's precisely this flavor I was trying to capture in my book. I don't think I did such a great job, but that whole thing of, second meds as a cocktail with your roommate.
Yeah.
It's, it sounds funny if you haven't experienced it, but that's what it was like.
Yeah.
And, it wasn't so terrible.
Yeah.
They called it milieu therapy. It took years. You just sat around with people.
Yeah,
and it eventually worked, although who knows, maybe it only worked because we weren't so adolescent, so the turmoil died down.
Yeah, and I had a roommate who listened to Edith Piaf all the time, and I had a friend there who read T.S. Eliot to me all the time.
See, you got an education in McLean.
Yeah.
Just as good as an Ivy League one.
And I rode horses. So there were a lot of, but it does do something to you that, you know, you really can't explain to anyone a period of your life that's taken that, you know, it's hard to sort of, and it was sort of comforting there, too.
Linda, what made you better? Or was it just
better
getting through the teen years?
I don't know if I'm better, but I think you just sort of, actually, maybe just growing up or... it's just, I don't think a lot of people there were very ill.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them were, because I saw a lot of things, catatonics and so forth. But I think a lot of them just were sort of, I don't think a lot of people were very extremely drooling, like she said. It wasn't...
Susanna Kaysen's memory of her own life was that in the process, her misery was transformed into common unhappiness. I hope it's that, or maybe even sweeter for you, Linda, but thank you for calling. 1-800-423-8255. Jennifer is on the line.
Hello.
Welcome, Jennifer.
Thanks. I was also a patient at McLean, but I was there in 1990, and my diagnosis was major depression. And I first wanted to comment on that caller. I think her name was Annalise, who said she thinks depression is a good thing and adds texture to your life. This woman has not dealt with major depression. I asked my family, asked my daughter, asked my husband if depression adds texture to our lives. We deal with it constantly. But I, too, was brought there. You know, I was in college, and I wasn't doing well in school, and I just was, you know, severe melancholy. But I have to say, maybe because it was 1990, there were a lot of very sick people there. And one of the reasons I think McLean helped me, it was sort of a scared into health sort of thing. Exactly. So a lot of people who this was their life. They sort of did the mental hospital circuit and were in and out and in and out. And I, you know, once I was put on the right medication and started improving, which I think was really the basis for my recovery, you know, as much as I've recovered, I saw what was going on around me, and I thought, oh, you know, I'll be damned if this is going to be my life. You know, so in that way, it was very helpful. So maybe because, you know, the insurance was starting to get stricter, it was...
Yes, I think a lot of things have changed because of insurance policies, and that can be good.
In brief, meaning what?
Well, insurers won't permit long stays, 19-month stays in mental hospitals anymore. And, in fact, it's the opposite. The problem now is if you've made a suicide attempt, it's very hard to get in. So it's swung the other way. You know, I think it's good that especially young people are not locked up for years anymore. I think that's really too disruptive for 99% of the population. But I think it's very bad that access to safety, I mean, you need safety, you need havens, you need places where people can be taken care of. That has become very difficult.
Yours were the good old days when you write that it cost $60 a day, which is peanuts
nothing
compared to today. Did insurance pay for your 2 years?
Some of it, not all of it. Some of it.
Jennifer, thank you. 1-800-423-8255. The girl interrupted connection. Dorothy is on the line.
Hello.
Welcome, Dorothy.
Hi. I have to say, I'm driving down the Mass Pike, and I've been listening to this whole thing. I was locked up in 1960 at the age of 19 after what sounds pretty similar to Susanna, a drug overdose. And I was put in a small private place in Massachusetts, Baldpate, where I was given insulin shock, electric shock. I was then, this whole thing continued for 3 years, one hospital after another. And I have to say, my roommate died from the insulin. I was put in solitary confinement many, 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 many times. I couldn't get out. And what happened when I was in there, and I'm calling because I haven't heard anyone say just how bad it was. It was horrible. And what many of us did while we were in there, because we couldn't get out, as we were all vying for various forms of attention, and I did burn myself with cigarettes. It was something that I learned I never would have ever thought of doing such a thing if I'd been outside. We learned to cut ourselves because we saw other kids doing that, and you got attention if you did. And I'm just calling to say that after spending 3 years in there as a teenager, I have really never quite recovered. I married, had children, and I have a job, et cetera, but it was absolutely, as she said for her, the formative experience in my life, but not in any way a positive experience.
The wrong journey.
Yes.
A terrible, terrible journey. And it's a miracle that I lived through it. Honestly, there were several people who did not live through it.
No, it is a miracle you lived through it.
It was...
Thank God you did.
Terrible. I went and I read your book, which I thought was very interesting. I saw the movie, and I thought the best part about it was Angelina Jolie. She was incredible. She was very accurate.
Yes, very amazing.
Very
amazing.
She was amazing. She was totally accurate.
Yeah.
And the only thing I can say about the book and the movie is they weren't nearly bad enough.
Well, I was lucky. McLean was a very good place. It's a very good place. There was very little of what you're talking about going on there when I was there. A little bit, but not much. So I know what you're talking about, though. Pretty awful.
Dorothy, thank you, and all the best. 1-800-423-8255. Tim is on the line. Hello, Tim? Are you there, Tim? Tim, try it again at 1-800-423-8255. Julie is on the line.
Hey.
Hello, Julie.
I'm calling from Watertown.
Thank you.
I guess you could say, I have been labeled chronic. I have had at least 50 psychiatric hospitalizations, including a number at McLean until my insurance ran out, and, also at Metropolitan State Hospital, in Waltham, which is right down the street from McLean. That was 1986. And, recently I had my first and hopefully only, really serious physical problem. I broke my leg, and I was in the hospital after surgery and got out. And during that time, I received two bouquets of flowers. In all of my 50-plus psychiatric hospitalizations, I have received just that many, two bouquets of flowers.
Two bouquets for a broken leg, none for 50 hospitalizations for mental illness. And interpret the score there. What did that tell you?
Stay out of the loony bin. Bad perks.
Yeah, I it's astounding, though, how much your quality of treatment is really determined by how much insurance you have.
Mm-hmm.
Even at McLean.
Why exempt McLean?
Well, as soon as your insurance runs out.
Yeah.
I think she's also on another point about, to kind of, as a filmmaker, you get drawn to these images like the bouquets. I mean, no matter how much we've talked about mental illness as an illness, really society hasn't accepted it as such. I mean, this, when you were asking me, Chris, earlier, what were some of the reasons I wanted to get involved in making this into a film? I don't know if anyone has seen my first movie, Heavy, but, I was very interested in just issues of obesity and ugliness in that film and what we label as that. And that there's many afflictions and or things that happen that society, no matter how kind of, progressive we've become, we still look at as, quote, your fault. When we meet someone who's gained 25 pounds, we don't say anything to ourselves, but, they let themselves go. I mean, there are a lot of things that carry a stigma of blame, and both families, friends, and strangers have a very hard time coping with someone kind of losing it because they feel it has to be due to some kind of lack of will, strength, or character.
Jermaine Gold, I just want to ask Susanna Kazin of the time we have left, and it's not much. Do you, I want to say, laugh at this story now? I mean, you smile beautifully
my own
about
story?
It. Yeah.
No, I don't laugh at it. I don't laugh at it. It was very painful. But that pain made me who I am. So I can't reject it. I have to embrace it.
Well, I just have to agree with all the people who say, rightly, you write beautifully about it. Susanna Kazin, thank you. Jim Mendel, thank you for joining us from Hollywood. We had help today from George Hicks, Rebecca Smuckler, and Kim Bichari. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston.
Cassettes of The Connection are available for $15, including shipping and handling. To order, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287.
Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
BRI, Public Radio International.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up this afternoon on Talk of the Nation with Melinda Pincava, a look at the promise and pitfalls of Internet voting. And then in the second hour, a conversation with world-renowned author V.S. Nyman.